I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. If you listen regularly to our show, you've heard many of our guests talk about how places grow, how we get from one place to another, how we live more sustainably. Our guest today takes all three of those questions and weaves them into one coherent set of policies that can help make next-generation cities a reality. He is Doug Farr, author of the new book, Sustainable Urbanism. Doug is an architect, urban designer, and founding principal and president of Farr Associates in Chicago. He chaired the U.S. Green Building Council's Lead for Neighborhood Development Core Committee. We'll talk to Doug Farr about sustainable urbanism and the 2030 Community Challenge today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Doug Farr is an architect and urban designer, and he is the founding principal and president of Farr Associates in Chicago. His new book is Sustainable Urbanism, published by John Wiley & Sons. Doug chairs the AIA Chicago Committee on the Environment and is the chair of the U.S. Green Building Council's Lead for Neighborhood Development Core Committee. Doug, you've tried to bring the best and most current thinking to the subject of sustainability. What are the fundamentals of urban sustainability?
Thanks for asking, Carol. The book identifies sustainable urbanism as the combination of a very long 5,000-year tradition of how people settle land, that is urbanism, based on distances one can travel in a day on foot, with modern-day principles of sustainability, concerns with energy, water, resources, materials, and the like. It's really at the cutting edge. Urban sustainability, I think, combines very old ideas with very new thinking. And so urbanism, that is the way we settle land, organized around how far we can walk in a day, is a really old pattern. And to me, that is the basis for all discussions about sustainability. You can't have sustainability unless that is present. Now, urbanism isn't sufficient in the modern day to deliver sustainability the way we need it. So it needs to be augmented with high-performance buildings, often called green buildings, and a new emerging field which excites me terribly much, high-performance infrastructure, which is the delivery of infrastructure that does new things. And so I hope we get to talk about all of that.
When we talk about sustainability today, most of what we talk about is technology. It seems that walkability has got lost in the discussion. What role does walkability play in sustainability?
Well, it's an interesting time because I think of 2007 as the tipping point year in which the public went from skeptic to, if you had a pulse, you had to pay attention, and this is something that's going to drive our future and a lot of policy decisions and ultimately a lot of family and individual decisions. But when you hear even leaders like Al Gore talk about what the remedies are, what we need to do differently, the focus, as you've discussed, is overwhelmingly on the widget. The problem is not our lifestyle or our consumering ways. It is our light bulbs, why our light bulbs simply aren't efficient enough to support the lifestyle we want to have without compromise. It's not that we drive too much, it's that the technology of the cars is faulty and doesn't allow us to drive as much as we'd like without, you know, causing pollution. So we are at the beginning stages of denial in some ways. When you focus on the technology, you're overlooking the fact that behind that wheel of that car is a driver, and behind the person that switches on the light bulb is a building that grew in size over the last 30 years. Our houses, this is one of the sort of terrible sort of downsides, I think, of efficiency and obsessive focus on efficiency is that, for example, the average American house has grown in size from 1970 to the year 2000 from what I believe was an average square footage of about 1,600 square feet to about 2,400 square feet. So it's grown in size by 50%. At the same time, the average size of the American family, the number of people that live in that same much larger house, has gone from 3.24 citizens per family to something like 2.6. And so the house increased in size by 50%, the family downsized by a quarter or so, But we, at the whole time, we measure energy efficiency not per person, but per square foot. And so an energy efficiency per square foot has probably been improving, though that there aren't very good records on it. But we are losing the war because the houses are getting bigger and the area we demand per person is growing. And so we're never going to get there simply by efficiency. And so one of the brilliant kind of moments of urbanism, I think, is that it introduces market forces into the sustainability question. Americans will not voluntarily adopt things that inconvenience them or involve sacrifice. If you bill it that way, think back to Jimmy Carter with the sweater, by the campfire, the whole bit, people don't do that. Urbanism, think of it, you know, is a condition where people willingly pay more for less. 2003, and it's cited in the book, was a key year. It's the first year in which the average condominium in America cost more than the average detached single-family home. We have flipped and are becoming, you know, we vote with our pocketbooks in this case, and we value the urban form, the condo or the townhouse, now in our society more than we do the detached single-family home. It doesn't that tell you something? But what's interesting is people are paying more money for less. Think about Manhattan or San Francisco or Boston, where the dollars per square foot are nuts, off the charts, expensive. And those are the places, when you look on a per capita basis, that is to say what resources an individual consumes, that Manhattanite owns the smallest space, the fewest cars, drives the fewest miles, consumes the least water, etc. Across the board, they are the virtuous environmentalist in North America, lives at very high densities and paid dearly for it voluntarily. There was no government program that said you shall move to Manhattan and pay three times what you can in New Jersey, that sort of thing. Now, most of America does not want to live in Manhattan. I use that simply as an illustration of one extreme. The same principles apply to simply walkable neighborhoods. Neighborhood is a term I like to use a lot rather than urbanism, because people can visualize it. A neighborhood is where you live, and you can envision all the parts of a complete neighborhood. That is to say, there's a little town, a little neighborhood center I can walk to. Hopefully there's a coffee shop or family restaurant. There's a cleaner's, a small retail store. There might be some little shops and offices offering professional services or adult education, those kinds of things. But there's a little center. And so if my sports team wins the pennant or the World Series or whatever, and we have a little parade in the neighborhood, there's a place we all know to go without being told where the civic center in my neighborhood is. And so I think that's a model that people can get behind. What the book does, the book Sustainable Urbanism that I've just written, worked with a series of experts who focus on this question of the neighborhood. Sort of, you think of neighborhood interchangeably with words like community, which don't actually have a precise meaning in planning or in development. A community could be anything. It could be a virtual community online and so on. A neighborhood has a very specific meaning, which is further refined in the book. But it's basically this idea that in a neighborhood, we think of it as a pedestrian shed, sort of that catchment area that represents what a person will reasonably walk to meet their daily needs, year in and year out. But there's a relationship between those things that we want in the neighborhood, the coffee shop, the family restaurant, and so on, and having enough rooftops, if you will, sort of families living there, representing purchasing power to support those walk-to destinations. And so there are a lot of America that was settled after the Second World War was settled at such low densities, they will never support walk-to destinations. They will always be reliant and susceptible to drive to big box stores. That's sort of their shopping choice, if you will. And they'll have a community center, they'll have a pool, they'll have a little neighborhood park, but they won't ever have the sort of retail establishments that we are finding and research is finding, when you cluster them, become a magnetic attractor to get people to walk there because of the convenience of running multiple errands or meeting multiple needs on one walking trip. You know, who wants to walk to a park over there and then in the opposite direction, the corner store, and yet in an opposite direction, the cleaners? People don't do that. They want convenience of having clustered destinations, and the neighborhood, I think, is the vehicle to deliver that.
You've embraced the term urbanism in the title of your book, and yet you backpedal a bit by talking about neighborhoods. But we can't achieve sustainability at neighborhood scale. So should we talk about urban and urbanism, or should we be talking about neighborhoods?
Well, the choice to name the book Sustainable Urbanism was a calculated risk. What I would say is this: part of why the light bulb and the hybrid car and the green building are winning the communications battle in this sort of first tipping point year of sustainability is that they are easily identifiable to the outside world. Everybody knows when you've got one and when you don't. The LEED green building system really was brilliant in that it packaged something that was prior to that sort of amorphous. When do I know when I've got an environmental building? They answered it simply by saying, when you have a plaque bolted on the wall that says you have one, you have one. And so it was a commodity. So the broad banner of urbanism, as we've discussed, I think is a precondition of sustainability, but you will lose the communications battle if you continue to talk about it simply as urbanism. I think people appreciate the fact that there is a tradition of human settling land, and it goes on over millennia, and it's always been based on the distance you can walk in a day or travel, you know, on horse, for example, in a day. Those were kind of the metrics for hundreds and thousands of years. You know, hit the 20th century, all that mass amnesia, we don't do that anymore, and we wonder how we get back to sustainability. History provides some model for how to get there, but not every American and not everybody that needs to be on the same page, every mayor, city council, developer, planner, architect in the country is going to go back and get a 10-year PhD in urbanism to understand all the nuance of when you have it and when you don't. And so, as I say in the book, I focus on two things, actually, neighborhood and corridor. And I'd like to describe both of those. The neighborhood being, the way I define it, the sustainable neighborhood is a place so well designed that people will choose to meet their daily needs on foot. So that is to say, you got to run to the store, you got to drop your kid off at daycare. That's something that's either done on foot or on bike. Maybe in an inclement weather, it's done, you know, in a car on occasion. Those sorts of things. The corridor is defined, the sustainable corridor in the book, I define as that configuration of land use, typically linear, long and thin, organized around a transit spine, be it bus or bus rapid transit or trolley or light rail or whatever, that allow you to meet your weekly needs. And so that is getting to work, getting to the department store to buy clothing, which is never something you've never done historically in a neighborhood. And so that's part of it. So the ideal here is that everyone lives in a sustainable neighborhood that is itself part of a sustainable corridor. And those of us who live in cities and places that are served by transit probably already have those places in mind. But when we think of laying out how the next 100 million Americans that we expect to have in the country, both immigration and natural population growth, by the year 2050, where will those 100 million Americans go? My hope is that a lot of those people move into existing cities and existing settled places, and they are densified. That is, the intensity of activity is able to incorporate many more people living there than now do. But it's inevitable to me that some additional green, you know, what is now called greenfield or undeveloped land will be developed to accommodate those 100 million Americans. And just for your listening audience, there are 300 million Americans now, 100 million on their way. That's an additional third. This is not small stuff. These are really big numbers. But when those farm fields are being eaten up now in a pattern that, you know, is derisively called sprawl, I think of it as auto-dependence. When that farmland is being chewed up the way it is by, you know, home builders and so on, there isn't the conception of the neighborhood or the corridor beyond simply a marketing name. You know, people like tagging neighborhood on whatever they build because it'll help sell, or manor or place or park or all these sort of green. There's some hilariously inappropriate names for some of the things going on. The concept of the neighborhood that's discussed a lot in the book is backed up by a standard out in the world that I'd like to talk about, which is called LEED Neighborhood Development. LEED, many of your listeners probably know, is the Green Building Standard. For the first time, there is a standard that describes what constitutes a sustainable land development or land use. And that project is called LEED Neighborhood Development, and I've chaired that for not quite 5 years now. It's in a pilot phase. There are 238 projects around the country and Canada that are running through the pilot program to test the standard, to make sure that it makes sense, to tweak it, make it better, and so on. What's exciting about this is for the first time, I don't have to be an expert and you don't have to be an expert in when you've done a good job. You can download this standard and test yourself, essentially give yourself a report card on is it a good development or not. So if there are any mayors listening or city council members or developers or planners, I commend to you to go to the USGBC website and download the standard called LEED Neighborhood Development. And so it is a brand. It is the tool that can help make the neighborhood into a commodity, the same way that a light bulb and a Prius car and a green building is, and that commodity has been lacking in urbanism. And so people throw their hands up and say, well, I know and you don't, I'm an expert, you're not, so you can't play with my game pieces here because you didn't get a master's degree or PhD at the school I did. We don't have time for that game. We need to agree on some common standards that gets the message out and the criteria with teeth out to hundreds and thousands, and I think millions of Americans who collectively make decisions on land use and the integration of land use and transportation and walking, biking, and transit.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Doug Farr. He is the author of Sustainable Urbanism, a new book out from John Wiley & Sons. I've heard criticism that LEED ND favors greenfield development. Do you think that criticism is fair?
Carol, it's very interesting that you've heard criticism of LEED ND that it favors greenfield development. I got an email this morning from a colleague who forwarded to me the National Association of Home Builders criticism of LEED ND, and that was that it was prejudicial against greenfield development. And so I guess you can succeed, you can declare success in having struck the right compromise when both sides are attacking you. The truth is it was written with a based on science and based on metrics of what reduces car trips, what reduces land consumption. Essentially all of the environmental metrics point all to favoring infill development, development on existing land that's been in cities or in communities, in suburbs and so on. All of those locations are the ones where if new development takes place there as opposed to at the urban edge, families and individuals will drive less and be less reliant on cars.
But developers of new property, new neighborhoods, have an incentive to gain LEED ND status, just like they have incentive to market their properties because they've got a lot of them. They have someone there on site. There is efficiency in the marketing and the designation of seeking the designation of LEED ND for a completely new neighborhood. On the other hand, there's not that same incentive for older neighborhoods. I mean, who would seek the LEED ND status as an example? The developer's long gone. I mean, in essence, you have neighborhood associations, perhaps a CDC in some neighborhoods, but you only have, one and two units at a time for sale. So tell me again, do you not think just attaining the status itself favors greenfield development?
You've put your finger on a key point. LEED ND's initial focus is on new developments. They can be in infill locations, but they typically involve a single developer or municipal sponsor of a development. And you're right, those developments are in a position to capture the marketing and public relations benefit of an entire development or neighborhood having a plaque, essentially a seal of approval and endorsement that you can market to buyers and renters to say, live here as opposed to somewhere else. One of the challenges, I think, that we have, and it's really an opportunity going forward, is how we begin to apply the principles of LEED neighborhood development to existing neighborhoods. There are a couple of interesting pilot projects underway, one of them here in Chicago, that do just that. And so, for example, the Southworks project is a legacy steel mill that used to be on the shore of Lake Michigan in the city limits. The city of Chicago has applied LEED neighborhood development both to the new master plan development that will go on the site of the former steel mill, as well as to the existing neighborhoods adjacent to the steel mill that, frankly, lost population when the steel mill shut and the workers had no jobs. You know, the housing stock deteriorated and the population dropped. And so we are applying it, in that case, for the first time to an existing neighborhood. And what we're finding is very interesting. The existing neighborhood doesn't necessarily score as well under the rating system as the development where it's essentially all scraped clean and you can introduce the higher performing infrastructure and the integration of stormwater and so on is easier to do because you don't have a 50 or 100-year investment in old technologies and old infrastructure. What I would say there is the opportunity, which is an existing neighborhood is often perceived as having bought everything it's ever going to buy, when in fact everything gets renewed. You know, it's either once a generation or once every other generation. So streets are repaved, you know, I swear my street's repaved every couple of years, but I think it should be, you know, every sort of 7 to 10 years, a retopping. But a major rebuild, you know, should happen once in a generation. So you look at that street out your window if you live in an existing neighborhood and say, well, it's asphalt topped right now, which is a petroleum product. It sheet drains to a drain, unfiltered, and discharges into a surface water body. You know, how many mistakes can you make sustainability-wise? But in 10 or 15 or 20 or 25 years, that street's going to get ripped out and rebuilt in a significant way. Public works departments are among the most conservative places in the country, where you do it the next time the way you've done it for the previous 100 years. And so there's an opportunity for engineers and public works departments, you know, to learn new tricks. And so that street could go from being an asphalt top street that you know, pollutes surface water bodies into a street made up of, for example, pervious pavers, where the stormwater actually passes through the spaces between the pavers into a subsurface level where the water is filtered and recharged into the groundwater and might discharge minimally, if at all, to surface water bodies. By the way, when you do this, you do a couple other things. Blacktop, we're accustomed to looking at it, but you think about it, it's basically a petroleum byproduct. You know, whether it's domestic oil or whether it comes from a combative country in South America or in the Middle East, it isn't good stuff. You hopefully don't want to be associated with it. If you can swap that out in favor of brick pavers that look a little more like old New York or old Amsterdam or Europe or whatever, oh my gosh, people love the look of the brick pavers. It looks, you know, ye olde. It slows cars down a little bit. It adds character. I think it enhances property values. And so, you know, that figuring out that proposition, this will be an opportunity for cities in the years to come to figure out the proposition of how do we justify, for example, going in and changing our practices to reintroduce a new kind of street, and how would we have to account for the costs and all of the benefits that might accrue both to neighbors, to all of the taxpayers in a municipality, and to the region and the people in the watershed from the benefits of all of the different outcomes that will result from building a different kind of street over time. Similarly, the streetlights, you know, in a generation, you know, everybody's suffering with the cobra head fixtures and you can't sleep at night because you can read a book in your house from the waste light coming off the streetlight and so on. That's nuts. It's not going to continue to be nuts. And so streetlights get swapped out. You know, building stock gets renovated. You know, even houses, typically, you know, once a generation or so, you get a major redo. The mechanical systems are all replaced. The windows are upgraded and so on. And so there's continuous investment in existing neighborhoods and the building stock and the infrastructure that supports them. And each of those is an opportunity to turn the dial up a little higher on the sustainability factors. So I think LEED-ND will influence those kinds of decisions definitely over the long run.
After a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Doug Farr, author of Sustainable Urbanism. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Our guest is Doug Farr, author of Sustainable Urbanism. He's founding principal and president of Farr Associates, an architecture and urban design firm headquartered in Chicago. You've talked about new streets and new streetlights. Is that the kind of high-performance infrastructure you're advocating?
Absolutely. Stormwater filtering streets. We're working with a number of municipalities now, Toledo, Ohio being one of them, introducing this concept of stormwater parks, that is, in neighborhoods of the city that are not don't have enough parks in them now. Can we find locations to site new parks that do double duty, which is they might capture the stormwater that runs off streets, filters it before it's recharged into the groundwater? But yeah, those are exactly the kinds of high-performance infrastructure concepts that we're after. The town of Normal, Illinois, is actually, fairly unlikely by its name, pioneer in this kind of sustainable urbanist integration. Our firm, Farr Associates, did a master plan for them some years back for their downtown, and it integrates green buildings. They were the first municipality in the United States to require private sector development to be LEED certified. They were ahead of Normal, Illinois, was ahead of Boulder, Colorado, Austin, Texas, Portland, Oregon. It's quite a list. Normal really took the leadership position there. But in addition to that, the infrastructure is exactly this model of high-performance infrastructure where the streets, the water off the streets is captured and filtered and I should say filtered, by the way, in a very public way in the circle that's envisioned there, so that the water goes through a natural treatment train and is beautiful to watch, grows lovely plants throughout the year. And rather than spending money on public art, which a lot of people, we need public art, we need good public art, but a lot of times it defaults to a piece of welded steel that students spray paint, at graduation time, and people don't like that. Civic art in this case is the cleansing of water. I mean, what could be more beautiful? We have another project, another kind of pioneering toe in the water in this category of high-performance infrastructure, which is doing street lighting by suspending it via cables off the adjacent buildings. It's called catenary lighting, and it's common throughout Europe and particularly the northern countries, Scandinavia, Russia, and the like. It saves a lot of money. Every time you have to dig a trench to run a wire through it down the street, and you have to service that wire and so on, the foundation for a street light, etc., is thousands of dollars every time you want to locate a street light. Bolting it on the side of a building and running an electrical conduit up inside the building is a fraction of the cost of that. So for master plan communities, if the developers and the designers like that look of the suspended lights, is a cost-saving measure. It also allows you to dial with great precision where you would like the light. Do you want it over the center of the street? Do you want it over the sidewalk? Do you want it over the median? Where do you want it? It doesn't matter. There are no restrictions on where you place it with this system. And so we really like that, and we're installing that in one of the first projects that I'm aware of in the Midwest.
One easy sustainability goal to monitor is vehicle miles traveled, VMT. What is our recent history with VMT?
Carol, VMT, or vehicle miles traveled, is one of the sort of hidden challenges, I think, of sustainability. And that whole light bulb, Prius, green building mantra that I've talked about misses the point completely. Here's the deal. In 1969, the average American drove 3,950 miles per year. And 39, put it in a context, from New York to San Francisco is about 3,000 miles. So it would be each American getting in a car from New York to San Francisco and back, somewhere between Utah and Colorado, something like that. But you get the picture. It's kind of once across the continent, partway back. By 2000, I think the number is 2002, the year 2002, the VMT per person had gone up to 8,150. And so, again, we're starting in New York. You drive from New York to San Francisco, back to New York, and now you are, you get as far as Colorado or Utah, something like that, on the way back. So we've driven we're driving an awful lot more. Now, you think of 1969, you know, that was not prehistoric time. Certainly people were not denied, you know, mobility and couldn't get to the things that they needed to do. You know, that was the time of the Ford Mustang and the Plymouth Barracuda. I mean, it was sort of a fun time to drive. And I think, you know, Americans love driving. And so this is, you know, going back to a time like that is not unthinkable. I mean, we all grew up with certain people of a certain age, myself included. I doubt you are. But anyway, those of us of an age who were alive then and enjoyed life then, no, living was fine. It was not a problem. One of the things that the book proposes is a standard called the 2030 Community Challenge. And many of your listeners may be familiar with the 2030 Architecture Challenge, which has been brilliantly conceived of and led by an architect from New Mexico, a friend of mine, Ed Masria. And he has proposed a standard whereby the energy efficiency of buildings would increase between now in steps between now and 2030 so that the newly built building in 2030 would be a carbon neutral building, meaning it would produce as much energy as it consumed in a year. Oh my gosh, what a brilliant and aspirational vision. Now, that same thinking applied to cities and urbanism and how we get around is what the 2030 Community Challenge proposes in the book. And what it basically says is, can we, the standards set this way is, can we envision a 2% per year reduction in the number of miles we travel, be it measured by municipality, by neighborhood, by family, by individual. And think of it in your own life. If you said, you know, 2007 was my benchmark year and I'm looking at 2008, how many miles did I drive last year and what would it take for me to reduce it 2%? Well, it'd be nothing. It'd be a very easy substitution. I'm not sure what it would be for you. And then 2% the next year and 2% the next year. In the early years, conduct makes the difference. That is to say, I didn't need to go there. I mean, there'd be a number of trips. You'd probably just say, boy, I had a terrible time. What was I thinking? I should have just stayed home. You'd stay home and you'd hit your numbers. But in 5 years out and 10 years out, the sort of 2% per year starts to force you to look around you to say, well, wait a minute, what are the choices that are available to me to reduce the trips I might need to take? Do I live in a neighborhood that has walk-to services? Boy, if I don't, I'm going to have a hard time doing this. Now, your listeners may debate the merits of setting targets that seem to impinge on individuals' freedom for mobility. I'm not here to say anyone should be denied any mobility, but I will say that as a society, we cannot continue to ignore this idea that we continue to drive more and more each year. And incidentally, Carol, the CAFE standards that have been passed by Congress that go into effect in the year 2020, studies show will actually increase the amount by which Americans drive because the enhanced fuel efficiency will make it cheaper to drive and therefore Americans will do so. And so that imported oil, for those of your listeners who didn't notice, doesn't come from friendly parts of the world. If we are at war, there's a lot of arguments, and this is not what this show is about, but I think we want to go the opposite direction of needing to import or to extract more American oil to meet our driving needs. Those of us who live in the Midwest are further troubled, I think, many of us, by this idea that we would adopt a national policy, which I think we just have, to burn off the top 5 inches of Midwest topsoil in your gas tank. And so that is a short-sighted plan, and all of it is a moment in time when a snapshot would reveal policymakers and leaders are still in denial about this idea that we can continue to drive more and more each year, and somehow either technology or fuel technology will solve our need to do this. And so what it all points to for me is that the future is actually kind of fun to envision, which is what you want is to live in a place that you like living in and that you don't suddenly somehow need to drive 10 miles over there to find a coffee shop because your community lacks one. That's a sign of something missing. And so, you know, the idea that you live in a place and our collective opportunity is to enhance the places we are now and make them better and make them more complete so that a life lived locally is the richest life. That's what we want. And we also, one of the other trends that is not really in the book but is on my mind in this radio interview is this idea that when you travel across the country, the need to travel is diminished when in fact, when you get to the place, it is a lot like the place you just left. So the chain stores that are all the same across the country, on one hand, we like knowing that aisle six is facial tissues and so on, is a level of convenience. On the other hand, there's a homogenization that has robbed us of the regionalism. And I suffer that. I don't want that every place to be the same. When you go to Chicago, it should be different from Boston or the Atlantic seaboard or Seattle or San Francisco. These places should be immensely different, so that when you do go to the trouble of traveling to a new place, that you have your eyes open and there are different shops and the food is different and people wear clothes that's a little, adapted to the climate and so on. There is a bit of a desire on my part to have places be more different, and with it, the economies to be different. I mean, one of the standards in the book talks about the benefits of buying local as opposed to buying from regional chains. And it speaks to the number of the amount of a dollar spent at a locally owned store versus the same dollar spent at a national store and the portion of it that stays in the local economy. You often hear or read in the newspaper, headlines that say, oh, economic development is coming to our area. You know, five new national stores are opening up on, this corner and this development or so on. Those national stores, this standard in the book Sustainable Urbanism reveal, are models of extracting dollars out of a community, not economic development. They're actually the opposite of that. And so the metrics are documented very nicely in that standard in the book.
But do you have clients, Doug, who come to you and say, show me how we can be successful by being different and being local, versus clients who come to you and say, show me how to copy the last thing that sold the fastest?
Your question about what motivates clients gets at the heart of a couple of things. One is, are there a lot of places that are sincere in knowing what they want and are asking for the right things? Your question almost implies for the right reasons. What we're finding is this. A lot of places are starting to make a connection between competitiveness and sustainability. And whether that is the retention of a younger professional class that a community has invested, dollars in public schools in and university dollars in educating those people. And suddenly they're adults, they're in the mid-20s and they have choices and they can't be retained and there's a brain drain from a community. That's an urgent need for a lot of communities to retain the investment that they have in that intellectual prowess of those people. So regions and municipalities, I think, are starting to identify sustainability as one of the factors that helps people decide where to stay and where to go, and that the best and the brightest are attracted to the places that are the most progressive in these ways. And so I think that's what I see as a kind of an initial kind of draw from clients, and it's coming from the business community and from the elected leaders who see the 30,000 foot view of their region or their town as one that is in hidden ways in decline. And so that would be the first one. The second one is for private developers. I think the LEED neighborhood development standard, and hopefully the book will help further this, sets up a competitive situation where if I, as a developer in a market, don't do a LEED neighborhood development project, it leaves open the chance that my competition will. And so they'll have something that's offered in the marketplace that I don't do. And so if any of your listeners right now are developers, I say, don't be second, be first, and don't be low, be high. And so LEED neighborhood development, like the rest of LEED, has different levels, certified silver, gold, and platinum. And initially, I think just showing up and doing a LEED ND certified, it will, of course, always be a good idea. But if you're in a market where it's competitive, what my guidance to you is dial up the target, aim high, aim higher than you thought possible because you have more talking points. And to an individual or a business that might be deciding whether to buy or rent or locate in that development or that neighborhood, it offers the higher scores correlate to better choices that they are offered in their lifestyle, and that's the thing you sell.
I'm told you grew up in Detroit. Cities like Detroit have a real challenge. They are simply too big physically for the number of people who now live in them. How can you adapt a city's size to its population?
Carol, you've posed a challenge in terms of cities like Detroit, my hometown, and how they adapt to the population that now resides there. When I was in high school, I attended a lecture by Buckminster Fuller. This is 1971, and his advice to Detroit, and he was speaking in Ford Auditorium at the foot of Woodward Avenue, addressing civic leaders, and his advice was, Detroit, I've run the numbers, your population is going to decline from here on out, and you need to figure out how a city shrinks. And he said, and I've looked at the history of cities, and they're never good at it. But I will point out to you, and this is the part where my memory fades, I'll point out to you, I, Doug Farr, that Rome was a million people in its classic heyday, and in the Middle Ages dropped to a population of somewhere between 50 and 60,000, and it has obviously bounced back up. And so it shrunk. Those aren't necessarily relevant models for today, but what happened was they walled off sections of the city and simply declared them unoccupied zones. Now, they didn't invest a lot of time, I don't think, in policing that, so that they were sort of criminal, vagrant, scary sections of town, but that was how Rome adapted through the Middle Ages. So I don't know that that's any model for modern-day America. I think that urban agriculture is one of the things that the book talks about, and I have wondered on occasion whether sections of Detroit which have been depopulated and the buildings have been cleared block after block after block, which have, you know, conventional municipal infrastructure under the streets, there's sewer lines and water lines and power lines and telephone lines there for future, you know, if anyone wanted to build back in the future, but there are full urban blocks that could be farmed. Now, that isn't necessarily the highest and best use of land, but I think that might be an interim model for what to do with some of that land.
You've said that reforming the built environment is the moonshot of our times, but there is no NASA in charge. So how do we get there with such diffuse decision-making?
Carol, I think that the implementing sustainable urbanism is the moonshot of our generation. And that is to say, it's a call to mass action. And I think probably the most important work that we have to do in our time. So it's terribly exciting. Implementing sustainable urbanism by 2030 as the norm in this country is the thesis of this, of the book I've just written. And I believe it's completely in our power to do that. So let's talk about that. Who decides now what land use patterns and what built environment is out there? And the answer is it's a combination of local folk, mayor, city council, zoning boards, building enforcement officials, developers, architects, planners, and NIMBYs and community members who shape very much locally what goes on. On the other extreme, it is national standards written by really disparate organizations. The Institute for Traffic Engineers, for example, has a lot to say about the streets that you drive on in a typical day and whether they are oriented towards getting cars across town at high speeds or they are thought of as multi-use facilities that accommodate bikes and pedestrians are not afraid to cross and so on. Similarly, across the board, there are all sorts of national standards that are not in the power typically of an individual mayor or developer or planner to simply wave them away. So I think part of the opportunity of the next generation's work is to work systematically to go to the source of a lot of these standards and fix them.
Doug Farr is author of Sustainable Urbanism, published by John Wiley & Sons. Nate Berg, assistant editor for PlanEtizen, is here with a list of the top urban planning issues for the year.
This year, more than any before it, the discussion about traffic congestion moved beyond the traditional debate of roads versus transit towards a comparatively modern solution, congestion pricing. The idea is that by levying a charge on drivers entering certain roads or parts of cities, fewer people will be willing to pay a fee to get to that part of the city or drive on that portion of the road, and congestion will therefore be reduced. London's congestion pricing system is cited as one of the world's most successful examples, and it made such a big impression on New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg when he visited the city that he announced plans to create a congestion pricing system in New York City. Bloomberg's plan has caused much controversy in New York, but has also set off a string of congestion pricing plans in cities across America. From Seattle to San Francisco to Dallas to Miami, many cities are thinking about instituting the pay-to-drive systems. The move to curb congestion was further fueled by a nationwide competition through the U.S. Department of Transportation that called on cities to propose the best ideas for solving their traffic woes. Each of the winning cities included plans for some sort of road pricing system, indicating not only the willingness of cities to propose somewhat radical ideas, but also the willingness of the federal government to fund those radical ideas. But charging drivers is not the only way cities are trying to relieve congestion. Many cities are moving forward with plans to build light rail and streetcar lines. This year was an especially active one for light rail and streetcar planning, with a number of high-profile systems opening or reopening. Light rail lines opened this year in cities like Charlotte, North Carolina, and San Francisco, and many others have plans to create their own. In addition to light rail, more and more cities are taking a step back in time and revising and reopening streetcar lines. The historic transit systems that were built in many urban areas in the early part of the 20th century are experiencing a renewed sense of interest from local transit planners and politicians. Planners are citing the potential for transit-oriented development around these rail projects as a way to excite the local populations and development communities. And for streetcars, the systems are being promoted not so much for their transit uses, but rather for their ability to revive shopping districts. Whatever the reason for cities looking at rail, this nationwide trend towards building light rail and streetcar systems shows little sign of slowing down. Meanwhile, suburban growth, climate change, and virtually unchecked overuse have severely diminished the global supply of our most precious natural resource. Water is becoming increasingly hard to come by, especially for the arid regions of the country. Southwestern states like California, Arizona, and New Mexico are dry to begin with, but increasing development in desert areas is creating a demand that the supply just can't keep up with. But it's not just geography that's to blame. Overdevelopment is stressing aquifers and water tables all over the country, not just those in the drier regions. Much of the Southeast has experienced record lows in rainfall, creating one of the worst droughts in the region's history. Government officials in states like Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and North Carolina have been forced to lay down tight usage restrictions to help the areas manage what little water is left in their reservoirs. As a result, many lawns in the Southeast and Southwest are not quite as green as they once were. But feeding thirsty front yards is not the biggest problem facing planners and officials in these parched areas. The real challenge will be finding a way to slow or control growth and encourage more sensible use of water to ensure the long-term sustainability of our urbanized areas. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Bird.
More of the year's top planning issues can be found at planetizen.com. How does modernization affect our view of religion? CityView's commentator Walker Smith thinks sociologists may have it all wrong.
Boston University sociologist and Lutheran theologian Peter Berger was quoted in a recent issue of Economist magazine saying that sociologists, himself included, were guilty of a quote-unquote category mistake in their earlier theories about the impact of modernization on people's religious views. Instead of the widely anticipated secularization of society, religious pluralism has taken hold. As we see around the world today, fervent religious views are adding fuel to the fire of territorial and ethnic conflicts. Modernity has not seen the death of God. Rather, it has seen the fierce reemergence of spiritual beliefs and values. I find three things interesting about Berger's observation. First is the fact that sociologists got it wrong to begin with. The notion that religion would wither away in a modern scientific world driven by technology and reason is easy to imagine if your view of rationality is divorced from human experience and engagement. But this kind of person does not exist. I have always felt, for example, that the rational actor posited by economists was a fiction. Nobody thinks or acts like that. And now even economists recognize it. social psychologist Daniel Kahneman won the 2002 Nobel Prize in Economics for his lifelong work about the systematic ways in which fully capable and smart people consistently make judgments that defy scientific logic and rational choice. These judgments are not bad in any way. These judgments are just different than what scientists would predict using traditional approaches. This leads me to the second thing I find interesting about what Berger said, and that is the depth of the connection that religion has with us. Even people fully immersed in a highly developed, scientifically and technologically based post-Enlightenment society like the United States have strong religious beliefs, and in overwhelming numbers. Putting religion in opposition to modernity is a false dichotomy. Religion and science do not compete. People can and do embrace both. Our fight is not one versus the other, whatever side we take. Our challenge is to find the points of reconciliation that enable us to master one without losing the other. The robust strength of religious belief leads to the pluralism of faiths that characterize modern life. As modernity grows, the yearning for meaning, commitment, and spiritual fulfillment is undiminished. Hence, it's no surprise that religion remains strong, even growing, amidst the ever-advancing achievements of modern science and technology. The essential task for the future is to find ways for pluralism to flourish. And this is the third thing that I find interesting about Berger's observation. There is no stamping out religion, nor should we ever aspire to such a goal. And if we must accommodate religion, then we must accommodate and protect all faiths. People will find their own paths to God. In the modern world, tolerance and room must be found for all. At the same time, we must not continue to make the category mistake mentioned by Berger. Our choices are not religion or modernity, faith or science. Our task is to find a place for both. Whether religion is the guiding force in our lives or whether science fills that role, we must make room for both. There is no either or. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His current book is Generation Ageless, written with Ann Klerman. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.